On the Empire Podcast this week, we're gadding about with the man with the most jovial name in Hollywood, Pixels Josh Gad. Plus, the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast had finally tracked down Spook Central in New York. You know what? It's not quite as impressive without that scary roof and the stone dogs and whatnot. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, fresh and rejuvenated after a week spent inside a giant apple. And welcome to the Empire Podcast. Joining me this week are two colleagues of such lethal cunning. And you know what? I've turned over a new leaf.
Really?
Yeah, I've decided not to pigeonhole you guys in the intros. So I'm just going to, you know, there's so much more about you, Helen, than Supernatural and Dragons. So yeah. I'm going to set you up with something, you know, that speaks to who you are and not who I think you are.
Right.
Okay.
Like?
Please welcome our geek queen, topless Jared McNamara. I don't know who that is. It's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
She loves dragons.
I really do. Yeah. The thing about the toplessness, I'd just like to say, they almost never take their tops off in Supernatural.
Right.
Like, if just I was watching Arrow, which I have been, like, topless at least three times an episode.
Yeah.
But Supernatural, you know.
Does Jared McNamara ever take his shirt off in Supernatural?
Jensen Ackles has maybe like twice in the
Jensen
whole
thing. Ackles.
And Jared Padalecki.
That's close
about
enough.
The same, sure.
Close enough. Next up is our art house guru, a man who loves long walks in the park.
Yes.
As long as they're black and white parks. And you don't like subtitles, do you, Phil? I mean, that's something that's you like other things. What else do you like? You can help me out here, Phil.
When you say walk, you mean contemplative moment. And when you say park, you mean existential swamp. Mind swamp.
That's pretty much it.
It would help you out. We're telling you about me, a man that you've known intimately for 7 years.
Intimately.
Whoa! Enough of the intimately. You're gonna start podcast fan fiction soon enough.
I think that's
like
unlikely.
I haven't already written it.
Please never show us.
It's Phil Dissemblian.
Hi, Chris.
Hello. How are you?
What was your most thanks. What was your most movie moment in New York?
I got stabbed by Woody Allen. That was really weird.
Wow.
No, I didn't really do like a movie thing. I really wanted to go to the Saturday Night Live exhibition. There's an exhibition at the moment going on over there, but the two friends I was with didn't really want to do it. They weren't into SNL or anything beginning with S. But then I got being tweeted by the SNL exhibition on Twitter going, please come to us. You have to wonder how popular is it at the moment. I saw a really cool Jurassic Park two-man show called Hold On To Your Butts, which is not everything was sex related in New York, but it was two guys recreating Jurassic Park with a couple of props and a Foley artist, and it was very, very funny. So I think it's on a couple of dates throughout August, so if you want to go to The Pit in New York, it's an improv comedy club called The Pit, go along there, and you can check out their website when it's on, or Hold On To Your Butts is on Twitter as recent cutbacks, that's what they are on Twitter. But while I was there at the bar waiting for the show to begin, Kevin McDonald was there.
Ooh.
Now, does that mean anything to anyone?
Does that mean he's going to direct Jurassic World 2?
It doesn't, sadly.
Right. Oh.
Kevin McDonald is one of the kids in the hall. Now,
Does
that mean anything to anyone?
A different Kevin McDonald.
Kevin McDonald.
The Canadian.
The Northern Ireland centre back.
Yes. Him. Kevin McDonald was in the room. He was there recording a comedy album, and he was just holding court in the bar afterwards, and I was frozen by fear. I didn't want to go up to him because I know how bad my small talk can be. It's like this, but a million times worse. I just didn't do it. Have you ever done that? Have you ever seen someone famous and then just not gone up to them, even though they've meant quite a lot to you since childhood?
Do you remember the year that Apollo was at the Empire Awards and I spent all night going, no, I can't go and talk to him? Apollo from Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, which, the new one, Jamie Bamber.
Bamber, yeah. I was like, no, I can't, I couldn't possibly, no.
Did you go up to him in the end?
I did in the end say I very much liked Battlestar, and he was, of course, a delight, but, you know, it took me a long time.
Okay. Phil.
I think I said I like Battlestar. I could have said Apollo Starbuck.
It's so weird. I remember one time, I'm more like this with musical heroes. Mm-hmm. I met Teenage Fan Club once, one of my favorite bands, at a signing at HMV, and I'm pretty sure I challenged them to a fight. I can't remember what I just, something takes leave of my body at that point, and I just spout nonsense a bit like this as well. Phil, have you ever done that? You ever been paralyzed by fear when you encounter a celebrity in a place that you're not meant to?
I do that in interviews, to be honest. Oh, look at you.
We're going to hear that later on, aren't we?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, regularly. When you see them in the wild, all the time.
In the wild, their natural habitat.
All the time.
It's interesting, isn't it, that if you see celebrities in the wild, you get a lot more starstruck than we do when we do that for our jobs. If you know that you're going to see somebody, then that's okay. If you just see somebody on the street, you get a bit discombobulated by the whole thing.
That's what I always say. It's like you're in a room with Brad Pitt doing an interview. You know, I mean, it's exciting. It's a big deal. Then you leave and you see Titch March walking on the street.
Yeah.
Absolutely lose your shit.
Yeah.
Titch March. Mental. I've waved at least twice to Mike Lee, who I don't think I've ever actually sat down and spoken to. But he's just one of those people that you think he's like the cuddly...
Yes.
The cuddly uncle. Lee is a cuddly uncle
kind
that you've always had. And you just think you know Mike Lee. So you walk past and you go, oh, hi, Mike, how's it going? And he's going, what the fuck just happened?
Yes, he's a cuddly uncle who can transform into something dangerous and sinister. He's like Mystique. Mike Steak. You know that thing where you see someone and you think that you can't work out if they're famous or they're a friend, or they're famous but you think they're a mate? Because you recognise them.
Yeah.
Or there's someone you've seen on the TV.
Yeah.
In like changing rooms or something.
Didn't we do that with Mark Gatiss recently? We saw him after leaving. We were doing a podcast and I think we had to resist the urge to wave as well.
Yes.
It's like, how the hell would he know who we are?
Exactly. He wouldn't.
He wouldn't.
We were walking through Soho and we saw him and we're like, oh, Mark Gatiss, hello. Yeah.
It's like, oh, hey, Mark, how's it going? What are you doing? Let's hang out. Let's be friends. No, okay, bye. All right, cool. So this is a question that's been sent in via Twitter by @MAvery. I think it's Michael Avery. It begins with an M. Michael or Mark. I really should write this stuff down. But it's @MAvery1986. And he asks, what film in Empire Magazine's 50 worst films of all time do you secretly like? Mine, and this is M. Avery, not me, mine has to be White Chicks, # Terry Crews is a legend. Which he is.
He is. I mean, that's undeniable. I'm not sure that he can single-handedly save White Chicks, because there are limits even to Terry Crews' immense abilities. Mm. I was looking through that list, and there's not much in the way of redeeming features.
Shall we explain what the list is, first of all? It's fairly self-explanatory, but how long ago was this? A few years ago.
It's a few years ago now. We did a 50 worst films of all time.
And this is a reader poll, isn't it?
I would not have put the Pink Panther 2 on that list if it had been me. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Okay.
So I don't think we did it.
Number one on the list is Batman and Robin.
Yeah, you know what? That's one of the ones that I would be more likely to sit through. If I had a bunch of friends around and we were throwing popcorn at the TV, mm-hmm. I could see myself watching Batman and Robin again. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of the ones on that list, like Soul Plane, nothing could prevail upon me to watch that again. That was the most offensive, irredeemable, unfunny piece of crap I've ever seen.
You liked it then?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
So something like, for me, it would be Batman and Robin or Van Helsing. Mm-hmm. Van Helsing, because I feel like there was a good idea somewhere in there that they totally squandered. And, you know, Hugh Jackman, so it's not totally unwatchable.
No, it's not. Also, I was on set of that film. I kind of have a soft spot for it, even though it's total bobbins.
Do you know you have a different tone of voice for talking about Hugh Jackman than anything else? You'll be like... And then this happens, and that happens, and then Hugh Jackman arrives. And then this happens, and that happens. But when has that started?
I don't know.
This is a new development. Look, you're doing it again! You have one for thinking about him, which is just a tenner higher.
Does that happen for the rest of us?
Whenever
I think about Hugh Jackman, I mean, I don't know. Does my voice change?
The brandy pause. Oh, back to the programme.
Yes.
What film do you think doesn't belong on this list, Chris?
I'll be honest, I think number six on the list, and you'll agree with this, I think, Phil, as well, is Heaven's Gate.
Yes.
Now,
technically, that's number six and seven.
What the hell is that doing on that list?
I don't know. Me and Nick watched it for the first time recently, and it does not belong on that list. And it has had a massive critical reappraisal, weirdly, since that list. I don't think prompted by that list.
Probably.
But it's happened since it was re-released and remastered. Michael Cimino's epic follow-up to The Deer Hunter, this is, of course, which flopped very hard. It's very long. You could probably cut a day and a half out of it easily, but it is a masterful film and it certainly doesn't belong on this list.
Yeah.
But I guess because it's a polarizer, that's why it found its way on there.
Mm. Wonder how many of the people who voted for it had seen it. You know, no disrespect, but I feel like a lot of people hadn't seen it and had just heard it described as the worst film of all time.
Mm.
That's probably an unfair one, you're right.
Is it one of the most disastrous shoots of all time? Yes, I mean, in terms of how, you know, overblown it got and whatnot, but I don't know, it's not the sixth worst film of all time. That's pretty ridiculous. I checked the list yesterday, so I can't quite remember for sure, but I don't think, for example, something like Ishtar, again, which doesn't deserve to be in the list, but I'm surprised that something like Ishtar isn't on the list, whereas something like Heaven's Gate is, and is so high up as well. That kind of took me by surprise.
And then Raise the Titanic was there, so I do feel like, you know, there was a little bit of films reputed to be disasters making the list rather than necessarily the films that were totally awful.
It's kind of hard for me. I mean, that's the one that stands out. Otherwise, it is a series of just one-star clunkers.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. Did I read the wrong list, or is Sex, Lies, and Videotape on there?
No.
Sex, Lives of the Potato Men.
Really?
Very different film.
Oh, totally my eyesight. That is a different film. That one didn't storm Cannes in 1999.
No, I don't believe it did, no.
All right.
But it is dreadful. I mean, you know, there's Love Guru, Plan 9 from Outer Space is on there again. And again, you might have to wonder if that's one that people have just put in there based on reputation alone.
Yeah, I'd sit down and watch that.
White Chicks is number 17, by the way, just ahead of Dreamcatcher, which has a decent first act and then falls apart in spectacular fashion.
And it is Timothy Oliphant.
Oh, there's another change of voice there.
that's one was deliberate. That's not worth mentioning.
Yeah? Not Jason Lee?
No.
No? Not Damian Lewis?
Maybe.
Donnie Wahlberg?
No.
Okay.
Stop objectifying men.
I know. Listen, I'm so sorry.
It's disgraceful, isn't it?
I
leave the pod for 1 week.
The Pink Panther 2 on a massive godson and friend's birthday outing when he was about six, seven, with his dad and me. And his dad and me were the only people that were laughing. The kids emerged from that film ashen-faced, like they just sat through Heaven's Gate. But I thought it made me laugh a couple of times. God help it. I just think Steve Martin's funny, even in terrible films.
Yeah, pretty much.
There's a bit where, is it Dreyfus, his boss, is like, right, you have to fly to Tokyo tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And he stops and he goes, but that cannot fly. I was just pissing myself.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not very funny, but I was laughing.
That's pretty funny.
I thought it was funny. I don't know. Anyway, that would take it off the list for me.
Isn't Dreyfus now played by John Cleese? Because Kevin Kline didn't come back.
That's right, John Cleese. Yeah, so John Cleese and Steve Martin in the scene together. You can't put that on the list of the 50 worst films ever made, can you?
No, you can't. Also, it's a Harold Swart film, and the man, everything the man touches turns to gold. So you can't. Just based on that alone. What?
And nothing, I just had a... You're right. In my throat, yeah, I'm fine. Okay.
Just, I'm worried.
You just had a turkey in your throat.
What did I do? I just saw something on there that I don't think quite deserved to be on the list. Hang on, let me just double check what it was. I'm at the mercy of our incredibly slow internet connection and the fact my iPad is just frozen, so I can't remember what it was. Scary Movie. That's not that bad.
The first one.
Yeah. Compared to
like Scary Movie 4.
Yeah, and compared to the wake of dreadful parodies that it
many
unleashed.
Of which are on the list, and deservedly so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah. All right. So I think we've exhausted that question.
Showgirls.
Where?
Showgirls, over there.
You'd watch
through
it.
Through the window. No, that's on the list. Does that belong on the list? Strangely, Eden, which is fantastic and everyone should go and see, which we talked about last week, has a scene where they sit around and watch Showgirls, and somebody says, listen, you've misinterpreted what Verhoeven's doing with this film. So if it's... depends how you come at it, really. If you think it's a serious movie, then I guess it belongs in that. Otherwise, no.
Okie dokie. Okay, if you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, then you can tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. And you can also Facebook us, where we're Empire Magazine, and you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. All right, so it's time for some movie news. And I believe there is some.
I believe
which is
there
which
is.
Is good. What's, yes. What's happening this week? What's
which
what's,
is always a bonus.
What's the haps, Daddy-O?
Wow, you're so up to the minute. Well, something we're going to talk about, obviously, in the review section is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Mm-hmm. And Tom Cruise says they are already planning Mission Impossible 6, as it won't be called. They are apparently, according to Tom Cruise talking to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, they're starting work already and they're hoping to shoot next summer. Which is a pretty fast turnaround, actually. The franchises tended to be a little bit more spaced out than that. So that's an interesting decision, and also a sign of, I think, deserved confidence in this film and its prospects, because I think it's very good. Spoiler for the review section.
Oh, my God.
So he's apparently already working on it. He says we. I assume that means with Chris McQuarrie, who's a regular collaborator now with Tom Cruise, who obviously directed this one. I would be interested to see if he's the first director to return to the franchise. That would be intriguing.
It would be intriguing. As much as I, spoiler alert, like Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, I'd kind of like to see them continue the tradition of a new director.
But he might still write, produce, whatever. So.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, not. I think it became a tradition by accident rather than by design. But still, yeah, that'd be very, very cool. But yeah, so if they start filming next summer, it'll be out 2017.
Yeah.
So 2 years between, usually it's like 5 or 3 or 6 years between films. Okay, all right, why not? But, bring me my next Jack Reacher film. Bring it to me. I just read the new one.
Did you bring it with me?
The latest one. Did I bring it with me?
With you, for me.
I may have done. Do you want me to give it to you?
Yes.
Make
and
me.
By that, I mean, oh, that's the name of the new Jack Reacher book, people. We're not getting into rude talk.
Yeah, isn't it? No sex stuff on the Empire podcast.
Anyway.
That's for sure.
So another Mission Impossible, presumably then, they're looking at 2017. I mean, this is like such early days. Anything could happen. Anything could go wrong.
And usually does.
And probably will. But it is looking confident and hopeful. So that's nice.
It's looking feral and strong.
It is.
Speaking of things looking feral and strong, Helen, how does your change voice-o-meter go for Chris Pine?
It kind of goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello. And he's going to be Steve Trevor in Wonder
Woman. He is going to be Steve Trevor.
So he is now confirmed. This has been rumored for quite some time. Yes. He's going to be Wonder Woman's love interest. A couple of people were saying on my, feminist heavy Twitter feed yesterday that they
were
quite like...
Do you have a special feminist heavy Twitter account?
No.
Is this, like, I have just a special separate account for Liverpool Football
I know
Club.
You do,
do you have a separate one for...
That's my main account, okay. To be honest. But several people were sort of saying that they would like to see him sort of, screaming and having to be rescued throughout the film and not really do anything else then be described as a strong male character when the film comes out. I think that would be genuinely brilliant.
Can he run away from danger with like big heavy DMs on or something? And
something like that,
That'd be quite fun. I think they've signed him up because he's probably one of the few... He's a really good actor, Chris Pine. I think he gets pigeonholed as this, hunk. But he's really, really good. So he might be one of the few actors in Hollywood who can actually pull off saying the words, "Hi, I'm Steve Trevor," without A, him dissolving into fits of laughter, or B, the audience doing so as
That's
well.
That's true.
So.
He sounds like, is he going to be revealed to be the Mandarin halfway through this? He's got that kind of like generic Trevor Slattery type air to him. Tell me who he is.
Mm. Well, he's basically, he genuinely is sort of Wonder Woman's love interest in the comics, in history. He started off in the comics as a crashed World War II pilot or officer who lands on what was then called Paradise Island, what is now generally known as Themyscira. And that was sort of Diana's first contact with a human male. And she was intrigued by this species and decided to travel from her.
You start with a doozy, don't you? Imagine if I'd landed on that island. The only way is up.
She's got to be really disappointed when she gets to the mainland and is like, what, they're not all like this? Are you kidding me?
Slightly depressed woman arrives. Wow.
When she does come into a world where Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill are walking around thrusting their nipples at each other. So I think that's... Which I understand is the plot of Batman v Superman.
I believe it is, yes.
That's it, yeah. So, yeah, she's very much of a muchness going on.
Yeah. So anyway, he'll be appearing opposite, obviously, Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman for director Patty Jenkins. We're still waiting on more details than that. Mm-hmm. But it's due in 2017, so I would expect them in the fairly near future.
Indeed.
Horror legend, play carrier, and cosplay inspiration. Nosferatu is coming back to the screen.
See, Phil's voice changed when he said that.
Yeah. When I said plague carrier. Yes, he's coming back. This is Robert Eggers, who has been impressing people with his film The Witch, and there's going to be a new adaptation of the film that I guess was first made famous by F.W. Murnau back in 1922. Mm-hmm. That's on YouTube, I believe. Murnau's lawyers will be in touch, but have a look. Have a look at that. It's not just a great movie, but a very, very influential one, and I think it obviously influenced Werner Herzog's redo, kind of, a different adaptation, and probably the Far Show sketch with Monster.
I think it probably
did. The three greats of the horror.
So that's the only things that have influenced.
Yeah, well, and obviously virtually every other horror ever made. Yeah. So.
But also like Shadow of the Vampire, which was the sort of tongue-in-cheek making of where they theorised that Max Schreck, who played Nosferatu, was actually a vampire.
Mm. Yes.
Which is a brilliant film. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend checking that out because it's bags
yes.
of fun.
And What We Do in the Shadows, obviously.
And
last
What We
year.
Do in the Shadows.
All
yeah.
those films, you know, wouldn't be around without the first Nosferatu, and they're going to remake it. We don't know a very great deal more at this point, other than it's going to be written and directed by Eggers. And watch this space. Something else that kind of crept on.
Can I say two more things about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, no, of course.
First
two,
of
say
all,
three things.
Say 23 things.
Well, I'm
that.
Going to stop at two anyway.
But in a tone of voice.
I'm not sure I can do that. The first thing is that this was apparently the first instance of a vampire who died after being exposed to sunlight. That was not part of the original sort of Dracula novel, and it was introduced here. The second part, of course, was that this was a completely unauthorized, completely copyright-breaching adaptation of Dracula by any other name. They were actually sued for it. So it's interesting that we're now remaking the, you know, slightly unauthorized Dracula when we've recently, at least, failed utterly to make a decent Dracula.
I wonder if they're going to go young and sexy. Nosferatu Untold. That could be quite cool.
Yeah.
You know, get a young, sex, maybe, a, I don't know, a Hugh Jackman type to
Gosh.
Run around taking a shirt off. You know. I don't have anything beyond that.
No.
To reveal that he's covered in plague rats. I mean, how sexy can you get with this guy? He's got fingers like sausages, pointy sausages. If you say one more horror fact about this, Kim Newman will appear in a puff of smoke.
I thought that was only if we said his name three times while looking in a mirror.
I've crossed oceans of time to correct your review of Nosferatu.
Yes.
I apologise, Kim, if I've got anything wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, apologies, Kimothy.
Well, a really interesting story, which seems to have crept slightly under the radar a little bit, is that Mel Gibson.
He's back.
He's back. He's behind the cameras, and he's back in his native land, Australia, shooting a new war movie, a new war drama called Hacksaw Ridge, which is hard to say. Actually, harder to say than it looks. That won't be the tagline. That's in New South Wales this September, and he's got a big cast behind him. He's got Andrew Garfield, of course. Not of course necessarily, because of course Andrew Garfield is in this film. I mean, why wouldn't he be?
Because of the famous Mel Gibson Andrew Garfield relationship that's been going on for years.
Of course Andrew Garfield.
If you look back at all Mel Gibson's films, you can see Andrew Garfield appear
as a child
for like just subliminally for six frames.
Who is he in Braveheart?
Movie.
Is he in the van that appears in that?
He is
in
the
that
van.
He is the van. Spider Van. Sam Worthington, Vince Vaughn. It's obviously a sort of prestigious cast, and it's a war movie set around the Battle of Okinawa. So I guess there's a rich history of setting Pacific War type movies on the east coast of Australia, and this will follow in their footsteps. Mel Gibson is, for all his well publicized woes, a very talented filmmaker, obviously, with Apocalypto and Braveheart, etc. So yeah, a complicated one, presumably, as it unfolds, because he's carrying some noise around with him these days. But interesting to see that, you know, he's still got the clout within Hollywood to get, you know, what looks like potentially quite an expensive movie made. We're talking $65 million. So so that's an interesting one. And I'm surprised it hasn't been more widely reported that he's, you know, back in the game.
What's interesting about this, I'm going to throw this open for speculation, is that this is based on a true story. And as you said, and Andrew Garfield plays a guy called Desmond Doss, who was a conscientious objector. Now, is that where the phrase to DOS comes from, I wonder?
No, that comes from DOS houses in the 19th century.
There you go.
I'm sorry for ruining your joke.
It's not a joke. I was genuinely
wondering. Hold on a second. This is a man who is involved in one of the most bloody battles in the history of the planet. That would change the whole meaning of the word to DOS, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but maybe it became, I don't know. I was just wondering.
No, you're right. I apologise. I didn't mean to be so condemnatory of your... Of you.
Bullshit theory.
Of you.
Yeah. That's fine.
But
it's
he
fine.
Was, yeah, he
it's
was a fine. Medic, and he, you know, he was given the Congressional Medal of Honor for his heroics. So it's a Mel Gibson obviously made the
Gallipoli back in the day.
Well, he was in Gallipoli, but I was going to say he made the Vietnam, the heroic Vietnam. We were soldiers, so it's got a slightly.
He didn't direct that, did he? I thought that was John Woo.
No, that was.
That wasn't John Woo.
That was Randall Hopkirk deceased. No, that was. Yeah, that was Randall Wallace.
Should we just...
Yeah. Great, 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 of William Wallace.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think he may have left out a few greats, but
I think he got them all.
I think he got them. That's cool.
Yeah.
I think Mel Gibson's a fantastic director. And I know that, you know, I'm shaking my fist at him, obviously, because, pitchforks. But, yeah, it'd be good to see it behind a camera. Or he can do less damage. So, should we move on?
Probably best.
It's probably for the best. What have we got? Hey, Toronto. Phil's just handed me a piece of paper saying Toronto on it. Toronto hasn't announced its entire lineup, but the Toronto International Film Festival kicks off in September. There's a whole bunch of film festivals in September. There's Telluride, there's Venice. But Toronto is, I think, rapidly becoming probably the biggest noise of the September festivals. So there's a whole bunch of movies have just announced that are going to play premiere in there. So you got Ridley Scott's The Martian, which is hopefully going to be brilliant. Michael Moore's new documentary, which was completely previously unannounced, apparently, called Where to Invade Next. I got a feeling it might be political. No. I don't know about you guys, but it might be. A film I'm really intrigued by, Roland Emmerich's smallest film in years, I guess, Anonymous, Helen, one of your favourite films, is...
shit!
Is, hey, what?
Just something in my throat again.
You okay?
Yeah, I think I'll be all right.
You should get that checked out.
I will.
Possibly by a hunky doctor. Roland Emmerich's Stonewall, which is about the fight for gay rights in 1960s New York. That's going to be there as well. There's going to be a whole bunch of other stuff as well. Freeheld with Julianne Moore and Steve Carell. That's going to be there as well. As is Tom Hooper's The Danish Girl. With Eddie Redmayne.
Interesting.
And Alicia Vikander.
And Alicia Vikander. Is she in everything else as well?
Yep.
There's a whole ton of stuff. Stephen Frears, The Program, which is about Lance Armstrong, with Ben Foster's Lance Armstrong, Chris O'Dowd as the journalist, David Walsh, who started the ball rolling in the Lance Armstrong downfall. And there's a whole ton of other stuff. There's Legend, there's Lenny Abraham's new film with called Room, tons of stuff. Yeah, but I think that's a really good lineup, and this is just the beginning, and Fenice's lineup will be coming soon, and there's obviously, there's other things as well. Beasts of No Nation with Idris Elba, directed by Cary Fukunaga. I've never been to Toronto Film Festival. I've been to Toronto a few times, it's one of my favourite cities, but yeah, we should go. We should do a live podcast there.
Let's go!
Let's do it.
That would be amazing.
We'll do it on the street, because no one would be interested in us while we're there, but we should just, just take to the streets and busk one. That'd be awesome. Anything else going on in the world of movies?
There's a little tiny bit of news just very quickly to mention. Mm-hmm. Tommy Lee Jones is apparently up for the next Bourne movie. This is the one that, of course, sees the return of Paul Greengrass, of Matt Damon. Julia Stiles has also been announced. And now Tommy Lee Jones as well. So we're presuming, or guessing, if you like, that he's going to be some kind of like CIA type, officer type, official type, because he's in the sort of the realm of the Brian Coxes, isn't he, that we've seen in previous films, and one would imagine that he will fulfill a similar role. But who knows, maybe he'll be running around and giving Bourne a literal run for his money.
Does Tommy Lee Jones have a history of hunting people down on the big screen before?
I don't think he's ever done that.
No? What else? There's one other thing I wanted to talk about before we get into plugging shamelessly the new issue, which is now on sale. And that is, you just see the story this week that William Hill, which is a bookmakers in the UK, if you don't know that, have suspended betting on the new Bond theme, the Spectre theme, being recorded by Radiohead.
Yeah.
Because a punter went into a William Hill shop and tried to put down 15 grand on Radiohead, and someone at William Hill went, hang on, that's either you're deranged or you have inside information, so we think the Radiohead are in the running, so we're gonna stop the betting now in case we lose millions. That's kind of, what do we think about that?
I mean, to be honest, there's probably a massive overlap in Radiohead fans and Bond fans. So you can see it kind of making sense. And it's not like they haven't used bands before as opposed to like big belting singers.
But Radiohead? I mean, I love Radiohead, but they, and you could kind of maybe see them doing a Bond theme around the time of the Bends, maybe, and maybe OK Computer. But since then, they've gone a little bit haven't they? And I just wonder that that's going to be a little bit,
What's happened to them?
You can imagine like an opening sequence, the Bond is leaping away from the explosion, and then the screen fills with that would be good, wouldn't it?
That is stunning.
What
I would listen to
was that?
That was my best Tom York.
Yeah, they could do one of their like Kid A glitchy numbers.
If anyone just, you know, jumps to this bit of the podcast, they're going to think that their computers or whatever are broken.
Jimmy Bond.
That was my experience listening to the most recent Radiohead album. So.
Ooh.
Whoa! He has burn. Claws. He has claws, this one. But yeah, I think that I don't think there's any credence in that. Cut two.
Haven't there been rumors of someone else being involved as well?
Yeah, well, Sam Smith was a heavy favorite, yes. First of all. And then Ellie Goulding, apparently, has been tweeting and Instagramming lots of little cryptic hints. Like she tweeted herself leaving Abbey Road Studios, which is where Thomas Newman is currently recording the score of Spectre. And then you have, she tweeted like randomly a couple of weeks ago, going, live and let die. So, you know, Ellie Goulding, Radiohead. I mean, you know, I was only kidding about the last Radiohead album. I'm a big fan of Radiohead, but don't ask me to name their last album. But I just don't see that being a fit for me in terms of Bond.
I guess we'll just have to see. The more interesting question is, what rhymes with Spectre?
Spectre. Beep, beep, boop, beep, 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 beep. Run away. Tax, wow. Government.
Hang on. Have you actually already heard it? That is uncanny.
Let's just say, Helen, I have life savings that amount to £15,000, and I recently went into bookmakers because I lost all leave of my senses. I plonked it down in cash, and I went...
Stop it. You're ruining Radiohead for me now. Stop it.
Or am I? Or am I? Because
or are you Blofeld?
It's so spot on.
Oh.
Yeah, I like Radiohead. Yeah, you had a good pun, didn't you? You had a good pun, didn't you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't. I had all-time high and dry.
There you go.
That's terrible.
That was worth waiting for.
Thanks.
Right, the new issue of Empire is on sale. I apologise to all, everyone for that, by the way. Good news. The new issue of Empire is now on sale. It is now on newsstands in all good and evil and undecided newsagents. It is available on the iPad. Is it on the Android yet? It is, isn't it? We're on the Android, aren't we? Let's say yes. And then not... You know, answer any of the angry tweets.
Paranoid Android.
Do you expect me to talk? Anyway, so in it we have tons of stuff. The cover feature is Batman v Superman, : Dawn of Justice. We don't have the colon in the cover. What's going on with that? That's kind of freaked me out after all the last few months. So in it, Ian Nathan, who is our grand poobah, went on the set of Zack Snyder's movie and he spent a couple of days there and he hung out with Henry Cavill and Ben Affleck and there was lots of shirts being taken off and sweat and they went, Ian, can you put your shirt back on? It's really not becoming of a film journalist. What are you doing? So there's really, really great access and there are some new pictures, which I think some of which have been online. We put online earlier on this week. Interviews with Henry Cavill, Zack Snyder, Ben Affleck. It's really, really good stuff. And alongside that is a kind of Comic-Con roundup. Phil...
This is really good stuff, Chris.
It is, isn't it, Phil?
Really good stuff.
It's really good stuff. So we went to Comic-Con, but we didn't just... Because we wouldn't do that to you guys. We didn't just recycle stuff from the panels and whatnot. No. Didn't. We went out of our way and we spoke to people and we got new pictures and new takes and sideways glances and all that sort of stuff. So there are new pictures there for X-Men Apocalypse. There's new pictures for Deadpool. New interviews with Bryan Singer, Guillermo del Toro talking about Crimson Peak. We have Bruce Campbell talking about Ash versus Evil Dead. Duncan Jones talking about Warcraft and his new movie. We've got Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Ed Skrein, who is the new Transporter. We have new stuff on the very new Pixar short, which is Sanjay's super team, which is going to be with the Good Dinosaur later this year. We have Hunger Games stuff in there, Force Awakens stuff, and tons of other things as well. Plus, we have Michael B. Jordan talking Creed. We have Tim Bevan talking about Tom Hardy in Legend. We have features on Straight Outta Compton, which Ice Cube liked so much. This is a true story, that he asked for permission to tweet about it before the issue went on sale. So yesterday, Ice Cube, formerly of the Empire podcast, of course,
tweeted the live one.
The live Empire podcast, episode 100, if you want to go back and listen to it. I don't do a Tom York impression on that one. You might be delighted to know. Tweeted us. Ice Cube tweeted us. I mean, what's going on?
Oh, that's amazing. He called it the bomb, didn't he? The bomb.
Yes, he did. He called it, yeah.
Piece is the bomb.
It is. This piece is the bomb. What else do we have in there? We have Amy Schumer who is fantastic, and this is in many ways her year, and Trainwreck is coming up very, very soon. And we did a wonderful shoot and interview with Amy Schumer, which you can see in the magazine as well. There's a great backstory about the Ewok movies,
Caravan of Courage.
Yeah, the largely forgotten Caravan of Courage and the Battle for Endor. We remember. We know.
Yeah.
There's a feature on Maze Runner, The Scourge Trials, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, that's in there as well. We choose our 15 smartest cameos. And there's a really interesting career retrospective. Jonathan Demme talks to Ian Nathan. This is very much an Ian Nathan issue. He is on every page, sometimes hidden within a pixel. But there you go. It's a cracking issue. Plus, all the usual movie reviews and all that sort of jazz. And that's, yeah, there you go. So that's, and then there's a poster for Everest in the back as well. So you don't get that anywhere else. That's good stuff.
Yeah, it is.
That is good stuff. Oh, and I forgot to mention the cover as well. So we got Batman and Superman, right?
Yeah.
But it's a two-pronged cover. So if you lift up the first flap of the cover, you also get to see Ben Affleck as, I believe it's Bruce Wayne, is this right? And Henry Cavill as Clark Kent.
Now, why did they cast the same actor as Bruce Wayne and Batman? What's the thinking there? Is it just saving money?
I think it is. It's a union thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
It's something to do. And also, they got the same actor playing Clark Kent. And I don't know what to say.
That's weird.
And Superman.
No, wait, he looks nothing like him. Because look, Clark Kent has glasses. And Superman clearly doesn't.
So. Oh, also Clark Kent has an overcoat.
Yeah, and so. Superman has a cape. I mean, they look nothing alike.
Yeah, there must be a weird, I don't know, must be a weird thing going on there. We'll find out when the movie's out. Next March, the movie's out. That's a lot of movie news, and that's a lot of stuff inside the new issue of Empire. Creed, I'm massively excited about. Oh, and this month's Pint of Milk is Jason Fleming. It's very funny.
Interesting.
Very funny as well. Jack Whitehall's in there as well. That's good stuff. Bridge of Spies, we've got a picture of that. Jonathan Pryce is this month's Best of Times, Worst of Times. He was very funny in that as well.
Okay, well, that's the movie news. Thanks so much for that, guys. Okay, so up next is this week's guest, who has a first name that means to chaff, banter in a teasing way. I looked it up on an online dictionary. And a surname that means to move restlessly and aimlessly from one place to another. So when Josh Gad came into the pod booth last week, we expected tons of banter while he squirmed around in his seat. And we weren't disappointed, at least for the first half of that equation. Gad is, of course, one of the most notable singers in movies today. He's the voice of Olaf in Frozen. He'll be seen next year in Beauty and the Beast. And he originated the role of Elder Cunningham in Book of Mormon on Broadway, which I saw again when I was in New York last week. He wasn't in it, though. He's moved on to other things. He's also very, very funny. He's now manning up and starring in the Adam Sandler comedy Pixels, which will be out on August 12th. And he was speaking to Mr. Phil. Enjoy.
Very thrilled and delighted to be joined by Josh Gad on the Empire podcast this week to talk about Pixels.
Yes.
And also, hopefully, to bring back the summer. I don't know if you have that power.
I personally don't, nor does my character in Frozen, actually. Just by virtue of his association with Elsa, maybe he could convince her. I don't know. I don't know if she's passing through Britain or not these days. I don't know what her schedule is.
I imagine not. There's probably too much to be done here at the moment. It's miserable outside. You've been over, before we get on to Pixels, mm-hmm. just to reverse engineer things, you've been working on Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, I've been shooting Beauty and the Beast at your beautiful Shepperton Studios. And I mean, I just absolutely love working here. I think it's the most incredible place. Everybody's just so lovely and wonderfully accommodating and friendly. And I'm going to miss it. I'm actually...
Really?
You're wrapping up
friendly.
3 months. I do. I think that...
People say we're a bit frosty sometimes, the English.
I have not found that at all. How dare you insult my hosts like this?
But I... Oh, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
You feel chastised.
The British people are as wonderful as they are in the movie Mary Poppins. And there is...
They're all Americans.
It really has been just the most fantastical time. And Beauty and the Beast, which isn't coming out for 2 years, sadly, has been one of the true highlights of my career in terms of, you know, projects that I've worked on. I think it's going to be very special.
You work with one of our favourite co-English people, Dan Stevens, on this. Did he get? He's a very passionate cricket fan. Did he try and explain the game?
He tried to take me to a cricket game, and I was out of town. I was in Bath, and I wanted to go so badly. We did go to Wimbledon together, which is not quite as British, I think, as Wimbledon is. But tennis, I play in this. Yeah. I watch in the States. I don't play any sports, but I watch it in the States. But he did. He tried to get me to a game. From day one, I gave him grief about him leaving Downton Abbey. I was very upset. That ruined my Christmas, like a lot of other people.
Really?
It did. I was just like, wait a second. I've tuned in to see these two end up together, and this is how it ends.
What did you say to him? What was your abuse?
I was just like, why are you so selfish? What about the needs of the many, Dan? Yeah. What about the needs of the many?
I think that's like the equivalent of his Olaf. Like, he's carrying this thing around with him that everyone wants to talk to him about.
Yes,
and
but
give
I...
him, but in the difference being that they want to give him abuse.
Yeah,
and in your
that's
case,
true.
They just want to share the love.
They just want to show me hugs, which is also as traumatic, actually.
You getting a bit over the hugs?
It's just, it's an invasion of personal space when you're a perfect stranger.
Okay, well, I'm going to knock that question off at the end. That sounds like fun. Just lastly on that film, I mean, obviously you mentioned it's not for another 2 years, a live-action Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
We've obviously had La Belle and La Bête, but we know it probably best as a Disney animation.
Yeah.
You're Le Feu.
I'm Le Feu.
Le Feu. He's known as a bit of a bumbler. How does that manifest in your interpretation?
Reinterpreted it a little bit, actually. When I signed on to do it, one of the things that I was very, really certain of was that I didn't want it to just be a carbon copy of the character from the movie. So I think hopefully he's a lot more dimensionalized since it is a live action movie. And I think that goes for the entire movie itself, is I think that what came before us is so iconic and classic that you can't just regurgitate it. You need to give it its own new wrinkles to surprise audiences, and I think the movie has that in abundance.
Lovely cast, too, with Sir Ian McKellen and Emma
Thompson. Oh, beautiful cast. Ewan McGregor, Sir Ian McKellen, Emma Thompson, Stanley Tucci, Emma Watson, of course, Luke Evans, who does play Gaston, is just going to steal every scene. He's incredible in it. Everybody's just amazing.
Pixels is coming really soon, and this is what we're here to talk about. And Pixels is, it has the space high concept of an alien invasion that sort of manifests. It's like sort of War of the Worlds meets Space Invaders.
Right.
The aliens come, and you play Ludlow, who we meet as a kid.
Right.
Who's a keen gamer.
Ludlow Lamensoff, he's a keen gamer. He's also a massive conspiracy theorist and an unhinged personality. He sort of can explode at any given moment, which is one of the things that I think comedically attracted me to the character. And he's the first one to recognize these patterns that these aliens are coming down, taking on the forms of video game characters, which, by the way, I've done research. This could happen. It's not likely, but it could happen.
This is a prospect that I wasn't braced for. We deal with a lot of rain here. I'm not expecting like the Street Fighter 2 characters to come from the sky.
You never know.
Well, okay, and if it were to happen, what would be your dream scenario in terms of an arcade game coming to life?
I would say that hopefully it would be something a little less sadistic than some of the games we chose. I think I could deal with like Pong coming to life. Like that I could deal with.
Qbert's pretty cute in the movie.
Qbert's cute. Like yeah, that I could deal with. The dog from Duck Hunt I could deal with. Anything else starts to get a little dangerous.
But the dog in Duck Hunt only, it doesn't do anything. It just like
that's
picks the ducks
like
up
him.
And brings it to you. So
he's friendly.
That would be a rubbish alien invasion. Be sort of helpful aliens. Bringing you bird life. You do steal many of the scenes in this movie, and the one in particular springs to mind when Ludlow and Adam Sandler's character are all brought together to kind of tackle the alien invasion.
Yeah.
And you're put in charge temporarily of a group of Navy SEALs.
Yes.
And you are charged with giving them a motivational talk. I'm assuming inspired by the beginning of Full Metal Jacket?
Yes, a little bit. And it just turns into the most awkward pep talk of all time. I mean, he's just, rather than getting them excited, he sort of just attacks them and does so in a manner unbecoming to somebody who's never actually served. But it's pretty funny and outlandish and crazy at the same time. And it was a thrill because I just got to riff and play.
Because these guys are These are like enormous. They're like mountain. They're giants. Like the mountain in Game of Thrones, all of them.
Yes, they are.
The mountain, it's a mountain range.
It's like the mountain, the hound, and their unknown brothers.
Yeah. And there's you giving them just enormous.
And like, I'm Tyrion Lannister in that situation.
You are, yes. Well, yeah. In terms of like prospect and
yes,
ratios.
Yes, exactly. Like they eat me alive in it. They eat me alive, and I have to use my wits.
Mostly improv'd.
Mostly improv'd. Speaking of Tyrion Lannister, how good is Peter Dinklage in it?
Peter Dinklage is great.
And the best.
He's great. Did you, because you had a big hair in Jobs.
Yes.
Did you share any kind of like grooming tips with Peter? Because he wears some kind of a mullet in this movie.
No, I think that Peter wore it better.
Really?
Yeah. My hair in Jobs was a train wreck. His hair is, it actually has artistic merit to it. It's got a beautiful flow.
Yeah, it's got flow.
Now, Peter is, I'm obsessed with Game of Thrones.
Are you?
So one of the coolest experiences working on Pixels was being able to watch the final episodes of season 4 alongside of him. It was just surreal. I geeked out.
That's awesome.
And he's just so, like, he's just so good on the show that you're like...
So wait, you actually sat down and watched the end of season 4 of Game of Thrones with Peter Dinklage?
With Peter Dinklage at his home, at his apartment.
That's phenomenal.
It was crazy.
Because that's kind of, apart from the battle of, I've totally forgotten the name of it now, Blackwater.
Right.
Those are his moments, aren't they, at the end of that season?
Oh my God, and with his dad amazing. And that whole thing. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And I immediately started annoying him and asking him questions. What happens now? What are they going to
do? So is he kind of deadpan watching it completely dead? Does he have any facial expression watching himself? In his
Yeah, room? He's critical of himself, actually. Mm. And he internalizes it. Like, it's so funny because for me, I do, it's one of those shows that you watch and you just get lost in. Mm. And I'm sure for the entire cast of that show, it's not that they take it for granted, but they were there for 6 months in some extreme weather, shooting some oftentimes difficult scenes. So they have to, they have that baggage as well. But they all know that they're on one of the most significant special event shows of all time.
Yeah, it's awesome. How do you think Olaf would fare north of the wall?
I think he would probably, hopefully he'd be smart enough to just pretend to be a White Walker.
Yeah.
and just kind of go into hiding, right? Camouflage himself.
That is exactly what he'd do, isn't it? He'd just sort of try and blend in with the White Walkers and see how it went.
Yeah, it would be his best chance for survival.
Talking about Peter, all of you guys, really, the sequence with the minis,
listen,
where Pac-Man comes to New York. How did that work? I mean, I guess you had stunt drivers as well, but what was your kind of giant Pac-Man?
It was
marker.
Like a giant green screen. Sometimes, other times it was a tennis ball. And Chris Columbus's voice screaming at us, telling us what Pac-Man was going to do to us at any given moment. Need to give a shout out to Chris Columbus, our director, he's the conductor of some of the greatest visual soundtracks of my childhood, whether it was Gremlins or Goonies, or Home Alone and Mrs. Doubtfire, or creating the world of Harry Potter in the first two. Mm. He's just so good at that stuff and marrying characters to extremely high concept stories. And, you know, so he being at the helm of this really helped us to picture and imagine everything that we were sort of coming up against.
That's pretty cool. It must have been a temptation to sort of geek out about some of those childhood.
It wasn't a temptation. I crossed the line. Chris, how did you come up with Sloth and Chunk and everything? I mean, Goonies is just such, I don't know why, it's such a great movie.
The Navy, going back to the Navy SEALs.
Yes.
Were they actually Navy? They weren't Navy SEALs.
Some of them were.
Were they?
Some of them were. So, and some of them threatened me like Navy SEALs after.
Did they? I was going to say, because in another sequence scene afterwards, there's quite a lot of rump slapping on your behalf.
Yes.
Of SEAL ass,
yes.
I guess you'd say. I just wonder what the protocol is as an actor for doing that. And then, you know, when Chris shouts cut,
What do you just go, sorry, guys? Or is it just like, you know, that's something that happened, deal with it? Or, I mean,
I get behind security personnel and I say, just deal with it, guys. And then I, as they lunge at me, I'm protected by the on-set security staff.
How big are the on-set security?
No, they're everybody was so game, and and you know what you're getting yourself into, and it was just, it's the character's so crazy that sort of anything goes mentality was established early on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Your gaming pedigree, were you an arcader as a kid, and what game did you get your highest score on?
Well, I sort of grew up. I was born in 1981, so I sort of grew up into the tail end of the arcade movement, which my brothers were more immersed in, and into the world of home console, Nintendo gaming.
Yeah. Hence Duck Hunt.
Do you remember Mike Tyson's Punch-Out?
I love Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Really good at that, although I did use cheat codes.
What?
I admit it now.
To beat Tyson?
Yeah, I couldn't beat it on my own.
Piston Honda, though, you could take down, presumably.
Which one?
Piston Honda.
I forgot all their names. What's the...
That's all I can remember.
What was the other one? Grapefruit.
But it was classic, and Pixels talks about this. There's the combinations. You just learn the patterns.
Yes, the patterns.
Pixel
right.
plays on that a little bit, doesn't it?
I was really good at Galaga in terms of arcade gaming. Terrible at Pac-Man. Loved it, but terrible at it. Mrs. Pac-Man better at.
Miss Pac-Man. More of an incentive. I have to, before I let you go... Frozen 2 has to be mentioned. You've said that you don't know anything at this point. Nothing. What is next for you, though? Do you get the script at some point soon and have a date for getting back in the booth? And
I'm sure. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that that'll be the process. I only preliminarily know what the direction they're taking is, and it sounds wonderful, but. In terms of what's happening with our characters, I don't know. So we'll see. Presumably it'll be soon.
You'd like him to team up with some White Walkers, potentially?
Potentially, I think it would be really cool to see Olaf's dark side. Not sure Disney would be on board. But.
You have daughters.
I do, two little girls.
Two little girls. And did I read somewhere that obviously you're working with Billy Crystal for a TV project.
Yes.
Comedians, and they're bigger fans of Mike Wachowski in Monsters
Inc.
Yeah,
my
Frozen.
My daughter, Ava, my oldest daughter, is such a Mike Wazowski fan. It's obnoxious. So, I do the Olaf voice for her all the time. She could care less. Billy walks in the door, does an impression of Wazowski, game over. She's just like, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen. Like, go live with Wazowski. Go be Boo in his closet, because I'm done.
Amazing. Josh, I'm going to let you go, but it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Josh Gad, they're a lovely guy. Shame I wasn't around to talk to him, actually, because I would love to speak to him about Book of Mormon, with which I am utterly obsessed. Time for this week's reviews. There's really only one show in town this week at the cinemas. That's the return of Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
And in which Ethan and the IMF face their deadliest threat yet, Whispering Sean Harris. He's back. In fact, he wasn't around in the first place. But anyway, he's back. He loves rocks, and he loves fighting Ethan Hunt. What do we make of this one?
I had a blast. I think I tweeted Ollie Richards occasionally of this parish after I got out with the simple word, "Wee!" and he tweeted the same thing back. So, you know, go figure. Okay. It is, it's an absolute blast. So it starts off with the bit you've seen in the trailers of Tom Cruise trying to infiltrate a plane as it takes off, which he is not on board, which kind of sets the tone. A lot of really, really, really impressive action scenes in this film, even given the high standard of action this summer. And a lot of it is very practically done, which is fun to watch as well.
Yeah, nary a green screen shot in this movie, I would say. There's a couple, but I was really impressed by how practical everything was.
Definitely. And that's, I think a lot of that is down to Cruise, because he is incredibly gung-ho and will do things that men half his age would balk at. According to Simon Pegg, when they got to Casablanca to do their car scenes, Simon Pegg asked the stunt coordinator who would be doing the driving, and the stunt coordinator said, "I don't have anyone better than Tom." So you know, that's kind of a testament. But yeah, anyway,
he did all the driving in Jack Reacher, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. He knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff.
And so does Christopher McQuarrie, who writes and directs. Drew Pearce, obviously, was also involved in this story, which I think is one of the reasons it's quite so zingy and a little bit unexpected. But basically, Ethan Hunt becomes convinced that there is this thing called the Syndicate. No one else really believes him. He gets proof when he is kidnapped by Sean Harris's sinister Solomon, and taken to be tortured by the very mysterious Ilsa Faust, which is a slightly on the nose name, but anyway, she's played by Rebecca Ferguson, not the X Factor one, the actress from The White Queen. She is incredible. Anyway, she's set to torture him, but instead actually helps him escape. And it becomes unclear why she might have done that. Good guy, bad guy, we're not sure. Mm. Anyway, around the same time, Cruise is completely cut off from the IMF, which has been disbanded at the behest of CIA director Alec Baldwin. And he's left on a one-man mission to track down this global organization and try and convince anybody to help him, essentially. So that's basically the setup. He does manage to get back in touch with Simon Pegg's Benji, who becomes his initial kind of partner in crime. Inevitably, and you know, welcomely, if you will, Jeremy Renner, William Brandt as Will Brandt, and Ving Rhames Luther also come in to help him.
Luther.
But basically, that's kind of the setup. And he comes back into contact with Ilsa, who has more mysterious tasks that she could do with his help with.
Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun.
So, what did you think of this, Chris?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. I can't quite decide in my head whether it's the best of the series. I think it might be.
It might be.
Which five films into a franchise for that to happen is increasingly not rare, to be fair, but is something that is to be commended. Fast Five obviously managed to do it. Police Academy with Assignment Miami Beach managed to do it. I thought right from the off, it's really interesting. Their big stunt that they've been heralding in the poster and the trailers and all sorts, the Trom Cruise actually clinging to the side of a plane. Yes, he was strapped on, so to speak, but still.
Yeah.
Would you do that?
I don't know that I would.
It's funny, that sequence, because it just launches straight into it. It's like an old Bond, the way Bond films used to open, with a big sequence early on.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. Mm. But it's almost the best thing in the movie, in a way, in terms of just the pure. There's some good chases and stuff, but that sequence is just like, wow. Just wow, it's ridiculous.
Know. The bit with the water was probably what got me most interested. You've seen, again, in the trailer, you've seen him sort of plummeting into this kind of maelstrom. The payoff for that scene, I thought, was absolutely terrific.
I like that scene too. All the action sequences are very, it's such a confident franchise now. It knows exactly what it's doing. It's going to entertain you for 2 and a bit hours. Mm. And you come out and you had a good time. And it doesn't necessarily linger. You don't sort of think about the plot machinations for that much afterwards necessarily, but it was fun. The action sequences are all good. I just think that first one, because it's such an old school movie experience, there's no trickery. You know that Tom Cruise strapped himself to that plane. He did it like 5 or 6 times. You know it was crazy dangerous.
Do you know, I've still seen people who doubt that he did it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I was on a website the other week and someone was going, oh, it's obviously CG. In fact, you can even see the bit where it becomes CG.
Right.
And it's like, well, no, because there were paparazzi on.
Yeah, but
and
this
we've
is...
seen the shots of him actually taking off while attached to a plane. And then, you know.
The moon landing never happened.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I will say one thing about the practical stunts in this movie is possibly the main reason why this movie was able to be released when it was. It was originally scheduled for Christmas, 1 week after Star Wars The Force Awakens, and then Paramount brought it forward very late in the day, around March, wasn't it?
I think they brought it forward.
Yeah. We joked in the podcast that we would love to have been a fly on the wall whenever Chris McQuarrie took that phone call. But I think that the fact that everything is so practical allowed them to make it. I mean, they were still filming a couple of weeks ago, I think, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, they were.
So, you know, this to get this movie as coherent as it is, it's a fantastic film. Mm. I think it's really terrific, really thrilling.
Really good. And also, it I think will be a star-making performance for Ferguson, who is lovely.
Yes.
She is absolutely lovely. And and so kind of old school Hollywood. She's been compared by a lot of people I know to Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca. I think that's where the name comes from, if I'm honest. But also she's just got this mix of charisma and sort of reserve and just mystery about her that is utterly brilliant.
And she's stunning as well.
And she is stunning,
She's really making me doubt my loyalty towards Rebecca Ferguson. The other Rebecca Ferguson.
Oh my goodness. That is...
I now have two Rebecca Fergusons fighting for my attention, and this is, guys.
What a tough decision for you.
It's a really tough decision for me. She's fantastic. Cruise is great. One of the things that's interesting about this film is that Mission Impossible 3, I think in particular, maybe Mission Impossible 2 with that interminable love story with Thandie Newton's character. And let's be frank, Mission Impossible 2 is the worst of the franchise by a country mile. But 3 obviously tried to, I think, deepen and broaden Ethan Hunt's character, because before that we didn't really know anything about him. So it introduced a wife and the idea that he wanted a life outside the IMF, and this movie completely jettisons that. There is no mention of Michelle Monaghan, who returned at the end of 4. You could read the ending of 4 as, you know, either he's going to watch over her for the rest of his life, or he's saying goodbye to her because he knows that, you know, to be married to him is to endanger someone permanently. But in this one there's just no mention of a wife whatsoever, which allows him to have crackling sexual tension with Simon, with Rebecca Ferguson, which is great. You know, I think their relationship is really one of the most intriguing things about the film.
It is interesting. I very much hope, if they are going to do this sixth film, I very much hope she's back, because I thought she was absolutely terrific. She certainly made more of an impact, I think, than, say, Will Brandt did in number 4. And we should also say, by the way, you know, full marks to Simon Pegg, because he's hilarious in it. He's very funny. He's very good at reacting when Tom Cruise does something completely insane. You know, like, I mean, Ian picked out at the beginning of the review, but Simon Pegg going, "Are you sure you're okay to drive? Because like 5 minutes ago you were technically dead." You know, this is a good kind of character to have in there. You need that kind of voice of reason, I think.
Agreed. Great set pieces. I think it's got a couple of slight weaknesses. I think, Sean Harris, his villain is not developed as much as he could have been, and maybe isn't quite as menacing a presence as he could have been. And the third act, again, a bit like the last movie, Ghost Protocol, goes smaller. And there's nothing wrong with going smaller, and it goes very twisty and turny, and there's a really good turn from Tom Hollander. I won't give away who he plays, but it's really, really fun. But it's interesting that it starts huge, man clinging to the side of a plane. Then there's a great set piece at the Austria... the Vienna Opera House, and then there's more twisty turny heist intrigue, and then it's quite small at the end. But I really like
that. It's mostly two people running around Temple in London.
Fantastic. And I think Jeremy Renner maybe spends more of this film staring at the screen than he would like to, and commenting on the action rather than being part of the action. But there could be interesting
times. He's very fun, actually, in this. I think it's the second time this year where we've seen him make something out of a role that was nothing last time.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so there really only is one show in town this week, and that is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which you may have already seen by the time you listen to the podcast, but there you go. We had at one point hoped to line up a spoiler special for that movie with Christopher McQuarrie coming in, but sadly he's in the States at the moment. And couldn't fit it into his schedule. But we're hoping at some point, and we believe that he's open to the idea. So hopefully at some point we'll be able to, you know, disguise ourselves as someone else and drag him into the pod booth and make that happen. In the meantime, if you do like our spoiler specials, there's a cracking one for Ant-Man with Peyton Reed, which is available at the moment. There are some other films out this week. One is Iris, the documentary Iris, and Anne Helen is perfectly placed to tell us all about it.
I am. It's an Albert Maisels documentary, so instantly you know it's worth looking at, worth talking about, and indeed it is very good. It's about a 93-year-old New Yorker called Iris Apfel, and she is a fascinating woman. She was an interior decorator for years. She and her husband ran a company which would recreate old or interesting fabrics from history and from around the world. So that would help, obviously, with her interior decoration. But also, it just means that she spent a fascinating life traveling, being involved with beautiful things and beautiful clothing in particular. And she's always had bags of style. So basically, she has spent much of the last 93 years collecting fabulous things, clothes, jewellery, whatever. And she's now become a style icon. And people have been putting on exhibitions of her belongings and her style and her clothes. She's got these trademark enormous big glasses. She's a character. She's fascinating, as is her husband, who's coming up on 100 as we meet him in this film. So it's just a really interesting couple of people, and it's one of these documentaries. It's not, you know, it's not a big, huge, you know, sweeping story. It's not something that's going to trouble Michael Moore, but it is a really fascinating portrait of a person and a life in the way that, you know, Maisel's was really the best at, I guess. Mm. So yeah, it's a beautiful personality piece, a real study of kind of creativity and passion and just somebody with immense amounts of personality.
Fantastic.
Really enjoyed it. 4 stars we gave it.
4 stars for Iris. Brilliant. And we should mention also out this week, there's the Adam Sandler dramedy, The Cobbler, which we hadn't seen at the time of recording the podcast. It is meant to be tremendously awful, which is weird because it's a Tom McCarthy movie.
Yeah.
Thomas McCarthy movie, in which Adam Sandler plays a cobbler who finds that he has a magic cobbling device that allows him to assume the identity of anyone whose shoes he fixes.
Shoes he wears, yeah.
Yeah, he fixes and then he wears them and then he becomes that person. But, you know, in the right hands could be a whimsical delight, but, you know, check it out. There's also the Sofia Vergara, Reese Witherspoon, On the Run, Midnight Run-esque comedy Hot Pursuit, which we gave 3 stars to. So there you go. If you're a fan of Sofia Vergara and Reese Witherspoon, and who isn't, quite
who
frankly,
isn't?
Who isn't, and films being not as good as Midnight Run, then go and check that one out as well. Okay, that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We will be joined by one of the stars of Judd Apatow's Trainwreck. We don't know who it is at the moment. It could be either Amy Schumer or Bill Hader. We like to live life on the edge that way. Or we haven't checked her email about that. One of the two. Until then, Phil, how's your experience been on Empire?
Hugh Jackman. The Hugh Jackman thing has been a revelation.
Yeah, it really has.
It's like my new whale noises. It was Helen's.
I don't know what you mean.
Been really good. How's my experience been?
Yeah.
Loved it. No, it's been fun. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Phil. And it's goodbye from Helen.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to apologise to Tom York for any offence caused. I'm really sorry, Tom. Beep, 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 beep